Hello, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. The opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers, and this is a program intended for education and entertainment. It should not be construed as a substitute for a medical consultation.
Let's start off with some breakthroughs, just a big one that happened this year. And I didn't have a chance before the show. Traffic interfered, but I suppose you might all be familiar with that in your life. But I'm thinking about the first heart transplant, Christian Barnard and so on. I think that we had this year something that is just as much a historical landmark, and that's the first pig-to-human kidney transplant. Thousands, if not tens of thousands of people die every year waiting for a transplant. And by using CRISPR, a technology which is now celebrating only its 11th birthday, researchers have been able to create transgenic pigs that lack the antigen on the surface of their cells, which is the one that causes xenotransplant rejection. In other words, we can engineer a pig who is a tissue match for a human and has nothing on its kidney that our immune system wants to attack. This is pretty amazing. So we've got 90,000 Americans on the kidney transplant list. And as I said, thousands die every year. Planet-wide, I don't even know what the number is. This kidney came from a genetically modified pig. It took 4 hours to transplant it. You know, pigs and humans, full grown, they're, especially current modern humans, are pretty much the same size. And so are the organs. The patient was Rick Slayman. He goes down in history. He was 62 years old and had failed multiple surgeries. As soon as that new kidney was put in, it began making urine. He lived for another 2 years and died of unrelated causes. Rick is kind of a little bit of a hero because he knew he was on the way out and he had a chance to do, well, to sink one last goal for humanity, and he pulled it off. The other really important thing this year was a new antiviral drug to prevent HIV. And this is not a pill. This is a twice-yearly shot. It's called lenacapavir. It's given by injection every 6 months. And the clinical trial, which took place in Africa, was so effective that they discontinued it. 2,100 women in Uganda and South Africa who were in the study. We had the women getting the injection, and we had a control group, which was women getting the daily pill. So after about a year, what they found was that the number of women in the control group, got a lot of HIV rates. I don't have the number here. The group that were taking the pill, 1.5% of the women got HIV. The women who were taking the injections twice a year, none of them got HIV. So that is a home run. That I'm using all these sports metaphors. What is it with me today? I guess just because it seems appropriate. Lots of things happened that were good. We're going to talk a little bit about that right now. Some interesting studies came out. And oddly enough, I did not remember that I had read this one when I prepared this particular segment. But today I was having a conversation with my patient and with my administrative assistant, and we all agreed that we remember things better when we write them down. Key point, write, not type. And so I was wondering if the neurowiring of people who grow up only typing and write very minimally and I might add poorly, but I won't. Is there something about writing? And it turns out there is something about writing. Scientists used EEGs to look at the brain activity of 36 students as they either wrote or typed. Same students, by the way. When the students were writing by hand, their brain connectivity patterns were much more elaborate than when typing. And not just in the motor cortex. The patterns were also more complex in the hippocampus, the part of the brain that forms memories and encodes new information. There's actually some very important things going on during the, as the research, or Yamesh, oh my goodness, Balasubramanian said, there's something very important going on during the embodied experience of writing by hand, and it has important cognitive benefits. My patient remarked that when he writes down a grocery list, he often forgets it at home. But because he's written it down, he is able to regenerate it fairly consistently through memory. In fact, I think that's very true. When I attend lectures, I have been seeing more and more people with actual notebooks taking notes rather than typing. And I've done it both ways. I've been going to these functional medicine conferences now for, gosh, 24 years? My God, 24 years of functional medicine. And I used to get like a big thick notebook with space to make notes and the slides on them. And then they moved to away from that, and then they would give you all of the slides electronically, and you could have them up on your computer screen while they were giving their lecture. And then I was usually typing in another field to take my notes. And you know, honestly, the handwritten notes in the paper documents work better for me, and I'm going back to carrying just a paper notebook per conference and writing my notes because it seems to stick better, at least for people of my vintage. Okay, moving on. Let's hug more. Touch can lessen depression, anxiety, and even pain. While human touch is best, objects such as robots or weighted blankets do provide some benefit. Women benefit more than men from touch, and the sick and those in pain benefit more than the healthy. Interesting science from Dr. Helena Hartman. The type and the duration isn't that important, but the frequency is. So getting a one-hour massage once a week is not as good as getting, well, 4 or 5 minute hugs a day, which is the amount I shoot for. I always hug my patients, at least when we're not in the middle of a global pandemic. More consensual touch events throughout our day can help alleviate or potentially buffer against mental and physical complaints. Well, you heard it here. Science has proven. More on the line of cognitive therapy. The internet. If you're over 50, the internet makes you happier. If you're under 50, it's less likely to make you happy. Looking at 98,000 adults in 23 countries, researchers found that seniors who surfed the net had a 9% reduction in depressive symptoms relative to the mean and a 15% rise in health scores compared with those who rarely or never went online. Now, I'm not sure exactly what they controlled for. The systems engineer who analyzed it said, for older adults, the internet can be a lifeline to social connections, services, and information that might be harder to access otherwise. But I also want to point out there may have been some selection bias in this study because, well, for one thing, people who have access to the internet, there's going to be a higher economic standard, particularly in developing countries. So that's something to keep in mind. Furthermore, having it together enough to, so we've got economic, but we've also got the fact that people who are very sick or very ill may have some cognitive decline and not be able to use the internet as people who have better mental facilities can, and therefore you've got some potential bias here. And nevertheless, I do think that the idea of encouraging older people to use the internet, making facilitating them for that. I'm particularly thinking about people in memory care facilities. I actually think that a smartphone and with a simple scheduling could be a real boon, especially if now that we've gotten to the point that you can tell the phone what you want, like, please tell me what is my schedule today? And you know, it's a science fiction trope. The person wakes up in the morning and their house robot gives them their schedule for the day. Well, we could actually make that happen for our seniors. Oh, more research. LSD may alleviate anxiety. So the FDA gave LSD a breakthrough therapy status this year. A clinical trial found that a particular dose of a specific LSD formulation called MM120 brought immediate and lasting results. And this was depression and addiction. This is pretty amazing. Nearly half the patients were still in remission 3 months after the dose. But, and this is a big but and a really important one, unlike most recent research into psychedelics, this trial did not involve therapists actively guiding the patients. The drugs developer, and let's remember, industry-sponsored study, so probably a highly selected group of, let's just say, non-traumatized individuals did this study. But the company MedMind, and its the drugs developer representative, said improvement in many participants was more than double what we see with today's standard of care. My point being, this got through the FDA and got breakthrough drug status, which gets us to the point of, will my insurance actually buy me acid? Well, stay tuned. If I hear about it happening, you will be the second to hear about it here on Ask Dr. Dawn. And I have to take a moment and remind you that you're listening to KSQD 89.5, 89.7, and 90.7 FM. And I've got my two buttons programmed. I get on the freeway down there in North Monterey County listening to 89.7. And when I get to Aptos, I flip it to 90.7. And I have smooth sailing all the way listening to my K-Squid. Okay, bet you didn't know this one. Veggies may help reduce snoring. In a large study, those who ate the most fruits and vegetables were 20% less likely to have sleep apnea. This is heavy snoring and stopping breathing in the middle of the night. Never good. Certainly never good for prolonged periods. People who ate lots of processed meat and junk food were significantly more likely to have sleep apnea. And this may be, and this is speculation, so let's label it as such, a plant-based diet can relieve inflammation. The study controlled for weight, but it did not control for inflammation. And because fruits, vegetables, and nuts are abundant in nutrients, antioxidants, and anti-inflammatory compounds, they reduce oxidative stress in the body and may, I think, maybe even physically reduce some of the swelling that's going on. So things we should be avoiding. I'm going to start off with vaping, which probably sounds like old news, but vaping alters your DNA. Researchers compared samples of cheek cells from vapers. And these are cannabis, whatever we're going to call it, and tobacco. And they compared those with cigarette smokers, and they found cells in both groups had been substantially altered in their epigenetics, which is to say, among other things, the silencing of cancer genes. So some of those cancer genes had their gags removed in this analysis. The changes allowed the cells to divide more quickly. Step one on the process to becoming a cancer. These same mutations are what we see, among others, in patients with lung cancer, especially smokers with lung cancer. So this doesn't prove that vaping causes cancer, but it certainly points a finger in the direction that there may be similar epigenetic changes. And I think I can extrapolate to say that using this to stop smoking, using this to reduce your smoking, really good idea. Using this and blowing out tons of smoke, probably, or vape fumes or whatever they call it. Vape fairy dust. There you go. Anyway, not a good idea. So another thing to be avoided, xylitol and erythritol. That came out this year. These are sugar substitutes. They're so-called sugar alcohols. And they may be associated. In fact, a three-year study showed that people with the highest levels had double the risk of heart attack. And the mechanism of this is that this sugar substitute increases the rate at which blood platelets form clots. Probably the sugar alcohols are actually getting into the cell walls, would be my guess, or triggering a substance in the cell walls. Research is ongoing to come up with the mechanism. So switching to a sugar substitute has some consequences, particularly these. The green packages, Truvia, that has erythritol in it as well as stevia. So I try to steer away from that one and just use stevia if I'm going to use an artificial sweetener, because the data is that that one doesn't actually change my microbiome. And it doesn't have the same effect on the sweet receptors in the gut, so it doesn't cause the bump in the insulin release that the other artificial sugars do, like saccharin or sucralfate. Yes, sucralfate, which is the yellow package, and then you have the blue package, which is NutraSweet, and so all of these have the ability to raise the insulin release just as sugar would. And this little extra bonus of the sugar alcohols causing your platelets to get sticky, well, that's a good reason to just wave your hand in front of you and maybe take your coffee black. Okay, boiling water. Bottled water, all right? So we're not talking about microplastics here. We're talking about nanoplastics. Nanoplastics are like a 10,000th the width of a human hair. So just get your mind around 10,000th the width of a human hair. This is smaller than a red blood cell by quite a bit. A study found that 1 liter of bottled water in plastic has an average of 240,000 of these nanoplastics. These are so small they can move through tissue. They can basically go across the gut wall. They can get into the bloodstream. They can get into the kidneys. They can get into the liver. They can essentially... And what are they carrying with them, these microplastics? Well, they're carrying harmful substances like BPA, phthalates, the so-called forever chemicals, like the fire retardants. And these are small molecules, these actually can mimic things like insulin. They can fit into estrogen receptors. They can change brain development in utero in lab animals. That's a scary one. That the human data is just not there as far as brain development is concerned. We do have human data that phthalates affect things like male fertility, sperm counts, and the shape of the genitals in males, in humans. So we really don't want to be consuming nanoplastics. I know, it's like either an unplastic-lined metal bottle or carrying around glass and wrapping fabric or putting it in a neoprene sleeve so that if the glass breaks, you don't cut yourself. Serious, serious pain in the rear. But folks, we got to do it, all right? Particularly if you're pregnant or you have young ones. You just can't hand them a bottle of, you know, Kirkland water and really expect things to go well in the long run. One last one to... In our years of research, the good, the bad, and the ugly, environments with low air pressure, such as, 30,000 feet in an airplane. You're at about 8,000 feet in terms of your partial pressure of oxygen. So that's fine. That'll keep you alive, but your oxygen levels drop. Researchers decided to imitate this in an altitude chamber. And so what they did was they had 48 people spend two nights in either a normal sleep lab or an altitude chamber. And one night was after drinking, and the other night was after abstaining. And so actually it was four nights all told. So it was, you know, the same person doing this. What they found was that the combination of booze and high altitude conditions led to periods, long periods of low blood oxygen levels and evidence biochemically of strain on the cardiovascular system. So a little leakage of those cardiac enzymes, just like, we don't like that. We don't like a little leakage of that, because that means the heart is actually having some microtrauma. And while we like muscle microtrauma under most circumstances, we really don't like it under circumstances of hypoxia. That's highly inflammatory and not a good thing. I also promised you some data about healthy snacks. And part of the problem to eating healthier is that we all have bonded to these certain foods. Like, for example, cheese-flavored chips with so much dye that your fingers turn orange, and then you lick every bit of that off of your fingers because it just tastes so good. And like they said in that old potato chip commercial, and I just, now that I say this to myself, there in the back of my mind, the Mr. Smithers, you know, evil genius mad scientist laugh comes up. So it's like, you can't eat just one. Yeah, right. So like I'm saying, we need to back off on that. We need to cut down, but how are we going to do it? You know, it's very difficult to go to walnuts or carrot sticks. They just don't seem to quite do it. They're better for you. They make you feel sated. You eat fewer of them. When I get hungry and in the middle of the day, if it's not, and my snack is literally a handful of almonds. They're not particularly tasty, but I'm doing something. I take the almonds, I chew them up, I swallow them. I go on with my hand, you know, my hand and arm and body intensive activities, which are usually around the garden or something, doing something in the house, and completely forget about being hungry. And 5 minutes later, it's like, oh, yeah, no longer hungry. That's good. And off we go to get all that stuff done. So, the New York Times actually went to experts and asked them to mimic those ultra-processed flavors, you know, the spice, fat, sweetness, and salt. And so they came up with three things they're calling flavor dusts. These are simple spice blends that you can make at home that don't have any bad ingredients in them. Well, a little sugar here and there, but seriously, compared to the other stuff that we're dumping down our throat, these are really not that bad. So flavor dust for popcorn, and these can also be, a couple of these can be used just to put some on a plate and dip your carrot stick in, and you'll get a nice, crunchy, spicy treat. So I'll put these up. Actually, they are up at AskDrDawn.com. If you go to Resources, which is an old-fashioned folder tab at the top there, you will find the these, because my producer put them up yesterday. But essentially, you've got this is all mostly tablespoons. I'll give it to you. It's 4-3-1-2. So 4 of sugar, 3 parts ground coriander, 1 part table salt, 2 parts turmeric powder. So those are all the tablespoon measurements. And then everything else is teaspoons. a teaspoon of cumin, a teaspoon of black pepper, a teaspoon of cinnamon, and half a teaspoon of ground cardamom. So, sounds complicated, but if you look at the amount that you're going to get out of this, you're going to get like almost you're going to get like a third or a half a cup of flavor powder. There's more ingredients. Sorry, a couple more. We have a half teaspoon of ground fenugreek, half a teaspoon of ground mustard powder, and a half a teaspoon of chili flakes. So mix them together and throw a tablespoon onto freshly popped popcorn. I'm going to try that actually on, I think that would be really good on grain, like maybe barley or quinoa as a flavoring. So I'm going to give it a shot for that as well. Now here's the flaming hot cheese dust. We all know what we're talking about there. Parmesan cheese, garlic powder, onion powder, paprika, cayenne pepper, some chili flakes, a little bit of salt, and a little bit of melted butter or olive oil spray. So this also sounds really good. This can also be mixed in on top of vegetables. You can stir it into yogurt and make a dip for those raw carrots of yours that you're trying to love. And that sounds like it might work. Another one, this is for nuts, and a couple more recipes, actually. One is just like this one. I've never seen Worcestershire powder, but apparently somebody makes Worcestershire powder. It's mostly granulated garlic and granulated onion and Worcestershire powder with salt to taste, lots of pepper, and a little bit of paprika. That sounds great. And so my point here is that with a little time and energy and a trip to the spice aisle of your market, you can self-create in a weird way. It's sort of like the equivalent of food methadone, right? It doesn't get you high, but it doesn't. But you don't go through withdrawal. And it's not an exact metaphor, but the point is, if you're going to taper down from cocktail to mocktail, well, you can taper down from junk food to funk food, and finally get to healthy as your taste buds rehabilitate themselves. I decided to ask the internet, what were the most common vitamin deficiencies in the United States? And there was quite a bit of argument about the order, but not much in terms of discussion of the usual suspects. So with no particular emphasis, because I'm going to be a little agnostic, it depends on who you're talking about, older people, younger people, for example, how I would rank this would be very different. But vitamin D, B6, B12, folate, that's three of the B vitamins, iron, really, iodine, magnesium, and calcium. And the last two, magnesium and calcium, those are largely due to the, you guessed it, ultra-processed food. And there's one food that we are overdosing on by a major fact. And yes, it's not sugar. Care to guess? You're right. It's salt. Particularly if you are eating the ultra-processed food or prepared food, basically, that you have not spiced yourself, you are eating more salt than is recommended. So I got this next bit of discussion from the University of Washington's Linus Pauling, I think it's called the Linus Pauling Institute. I believe it's the Institute. And Linus Pauling, of course, did a lot of work on a lot of things, but nutrition was a big part of it, and many of you may be able to remember that he had a lot to say about vitamin C and cancer. And I will point out that whenever I talk to a doctor about this, they say, oh, no, that was disproven. And I say, Yes, but it was disproven by a study that used oral vitamin C, and the cancer study used intravenous vitamin C. And last I checked, you can't achieve the blood levels with oral vitamin C that you can achieve by intravenous vitamin C. In fact, the blood levels are an order of magnitude higher with the IV product. So that is a real apples and oranges, or shall we say horses and donkey kind of comparison. All right, so let's see. The number one health concern, according to Linus Pauling Institute, is calcium. Calcium status must be assessed through dietary surveys. This is important because dietary surveys, people remembering what they ate and how much, is really bad quality data. But there is no blood test for calcium. The blood levels of calcium are tightly regulated. They have to be. If they get too high or too low, everything stops. Same thing for potassium and a few other things. But these have to be tightly regulated. Dietary surveys show that many Americans are not meeting dietary requirements. The people who are least likely to meet those are older children, adolescents, women, and that includes pregnant women, and some older adults. Overall, it's about 40% of the population. Calcium is extremely important for bone, but it's also very important for muscle function. Dairy products, which have been on the outs lately, and particularly I think we'll see higher costs and lower consumption of dairy products until we get the bird flu thing whipped into shape. We're going to be seeing more and more people moving over to nut milks. Please check the calcium content on your nut milks. I have done that, and I don't remember the ranking, but almond milk has about the same amount of calcium as, you know, ounce for ounce is regular dairy milk, and so that's my choice for you. Iron is a real concern in young children and women who may become pregnant. So about 10% of infants below 1 year had low iron intakes, and yet by the time they're toddlers, it's only about 1%. And so we really need to emphasize infants. Breast milk has a low iron content, and so the American Academy of Pediatrics recommends that breastfed infants be given an extra milligram per kilogram per day of supplemental iron. So take the body weight, divide by 2.2, that's your kilograms, and then multiply by 1, and those are, and then your units there is milligrams. Some of the iron, the baby cereals are iron fortified. That's the usual way that this works. But it doesn't have to be the only way it works. If you want to follow if you want to avoid processed foods, you're going to need to bite the bullet and give the kids some iron supplements. Again, in adolescents, due to rapid growth, they get this big growth spurt. They need a lot of extra iron. And of course, adolescent girls are losing heme iron during menstruation, so they're at particular risk. So there we're up to about 16% of girls with iron intakes that are below the estimated average requirement, which is probably better than the minimum daily requirement because there's a lot of variability. And we can measure, there's lots of biomarkers for iron deficiency and things that happen in the blood when there's iron deficiency. But iron deficiency is a disease. Iron inadequacy is a stressor. The people are not getting everything they need. They are not functioning at optimum. It's back in the days when we had gasoline, we had three grades of gasoline, and one of them was kind of like the cheap one. And then there was the somewhat better one. And then there was the supercharged one, because that one would make your car go faster and not pop or backfire. And we need to get more iron into people. And as we've moved away from red meat, that's actually been, that is oddly enough, a major source of iron. Mixing acid with vegetables is a good way to release the iron content of vegetables And of course, iron, you can cook the heck out of something, make it very absorbable for a child. You can run it through a blender and make your own baby food. And if you do that with spinach and broccoli, you're probably going to get a kid who will actually eat their vegetables when they're in their teens, which is also a great thing to do. Now, magnesium is not labeled as a nutrient of public concern, but it should be because it's associated with increased risks of several chronic diseases, including cardiovascular disease, type 2 diabetes, and osteoporosis. More than one half of the U.S. population has intakes below the estimated average requirement, and that's 36% of children and teens and 61% of adults. And we don't have, again, reliable biomarkers for magnesium because magnesium levels in the blood are tightly regulated by the kidney. So the only thing you can do is order a red blood cell magnesium, which will give you some indication. But as we've moved to more processed food, and I have my patients do very thorough food logs if they want to. I do a two-hour physical on my patients, and the first hour of that is spent looking at their diet, exercise, hydration, stress, and making what I hope are helpful suggestions to improve their health span and, ideally, their lifespan as well. So whole grains, whole grains means it hasn't been ground up and baked into a product, okay? A product made with a flour that is comprised of whole grains is not a whole grain. So we're talking about kashi. We're talking about we're talking about wild rice. We're talking about barley. We're talking about any of the grains in a whole form, cooked and identifiable as a seed-like object. And these things are great for having the magnesium in it. It gets lost in the milling and the processing. So if we just had people eat more beans and more whole grains, we would get all the magnesium we need. Another one, and this is a big deal because of hypertension, is potassium. Most adults do not meet recommendations. Average potassium intakes are well below the need for all age groups. And fruits and vegetables are the main dietary source of potassium. Believe it or not, white potatoes have enough potassium to be beneficial. And the breast milk and infant formula both contain plenty of potassium. And fruit, the little kids eat more fruit because you're trying to get them to eat something and they like the taste. So kids do okay. It's when we become adults and we start eating bread, crackers, cookies, etc., that our potassium drops. We ate more fruit, vegetables, we would meet the requirements for potassium. When I see a patient with hypertension who does not want to take drugs, the first thing I do is I point them to potassium chloride in the supermarket. Well, actually, the first thing I do is I check their kidney function, because if they are in kidney failure or their kidney is on the ropes, their kidney will not deal with the extra potassium, and so it becomes toxic for them. However, if they have normal kidneys, their kidneys will be happy, and it will lower their blood pressure and improve their muscle function, and therefore it is a very good thing. And one of the big muscles, the heart, that's super important for longevity, is very dependent on the potassium intracellularly, which we cannot measure in the bloodstream, unless, of course, we get a red blood cell potassium. Almost never done. I've never been able to order that. I can get red blood cell zinc, and I can get red blood cell magnesium, but a commercially available red blood cell potassium, I just haven't seen. It's too bad, too, because it's what's inside the cell that counts. Vitamin A, also important. 51% of adults fall short. Let's talk about eye deterioration, okay? Low-grade vitamin A deficiency is associated with retinal deterioration. The macular degeneration that so many people get, vitamin A, keeping those levels up for years. And I'm talking 10, 20 years of maintenance in order to prevent a case of macular degeneration. But then on the other hand, once you develop macular degeneration, there's no road back. And the most you can hope for is an injection in your eyeball from the eye doctor once a month to keep your eye from deteriorating further. So the problem here is that the blood levels, again, are not useful to assess deficiency. Because it's so important in the body, the vitamin A levels are going to stay the same until you have literally squeezed every bit of stored vitamin A out of your liver. Then your blood levels of serum retinol will drop. But meanwhile, your liver and many of your other tissues have sustained injury. And when one has inflammation or infection, one's need for vitamin A is increased, and that can create a problem as well. So again, vitamin C, another one where almost 50% of adults don't get enough. And you can use serum ascorbic acid levels, so at least we can look at that. 6% of adults are severely deficient using those levels. And greater than 10% of adults had low serum vitamin C concentrations in the latest NHANES study. This is getting worse. And so we have to really take a look at what we're putting in our mouth. Vitamin D, you've heard me talk about many times. Sunlight is the primary source of vitamin D. So our best indicator to evaluate vitamin D status is 25-hydroxyvitamin D. But we don't have super good data on what's insufficiency. And deficiency is defined in various ways. But we want to see a vitamin D concentration that is high enough that you will continue to keep good bone physiology throughout life. When you're a child and you're still forming your bones, you get a disease called rickets, which causes the shin bones to actually bend like a bow, as in bow and arrow. As an adult, when you have vitamin D deficiency, you're going to get pain. The older you get, the less time you spend outside in the sun. And when we talk about older adults, there's a substantial increase in the number with vitamin D deficiencies. And I don't know if I talked about this article. I read it though, and I thought, you know, it'll just be me complaining about the problem with bad science and, you know, short duration studies for something that's a long latency condition. If I want to prevent a hip fracture, if I want to keep a woman from getting a hip fracture at 65, I probably have to start checking her vitamin D levels at 30 and having her supplement if they aren't adequate, let's say at 40, using the units that we use in the United States. And that is going to be over the long haul. But there is, in the few studies that they're not placebo-controlled, because you can't do a 20- or 30-year placebo-controlled study in humans. You just can't keep track of people well enough. It's prohibitive in so many ways. So this is the end of my... Oh, one more. Sorry. Vitamin E. And there are a few people who have genetic problems that interfere with their ability to transport alpha-tocopherol, which is the major form of vitamin E that we look at. We can measure alpha-tocopherol, but unfortunately, the measurement is very inaccurate, and it is really influenced by lipid levels. And the prevalence of vitamin D inadequacy is extremely low. But dietary surveys suggest that the actual amount of vitamin E that people are getting in their diet isn't nearly enough. So questions to me that this raises is that we don't know what we're doing. We're not correlating with lipid concentrations. People have high lipids. That causes their vitamin D to read as higher. Their vitamin E to read as higher. There's a contradiction here that doesn't make a lot of sense. And we do have data that when you supplement vitamin E, particularly not just alpha, but beta and gamma and delta tocopherol, you get decreased amounts of cardiovascular events. But the problem is these are all retrospective studies. They don't have that level of placebo control. And you can always say, well, that's because people who take that have a healthier lifestyle. And yeah, they probably do. But I think that's kind of a circular, it's circular reasoning in both directions, right? Okay, what do we eat too much of? I already gave this one away, sodium. The requirement for sodium is about 1.5 grams per day, and you would get most of that eating food. 90% of adults have sodium intakes in excess of 2.3 grams per day. And older adults are at about 3 grams. Younger adults are getting from 19 to 50 are probably eating out more, and they're up to almost 4 grams of sodium. And this contributes to bad effects on the kidneys and also probably bad effects on the cardiovascular system, because that is intimately connected to the kidneys. Let's go to more kids are getting kidney stones. And this, over the last 30 years, is really interesting. Kidney stones just never happened to children. But now it was middle-aged white men who got the kidney stones. You know, the guys in the hard hats out there sweating and, you know, eating guy food. And the high sodium intake, lots of sweating, lots of meat. And so most of the stones are calcium oxalate. And we can get rid of a lot of oxalate in our urine. But if we have to concentrate it too much because we're dehydrated, the kidneys stones can form. And it's very disabling to get this as a child. It takes you out of a lot of sports. You're not allowed to participate, and you miss a lot of school. Sodium intake in children in the past few decades has skyrocketed. And when the kidney has to get rid of the sodium, it pulls calcium with it. And that's to balance the charge. And so you end up with a lot more of calcium in the urine. And if the oxalate is also there, it's going to crystallize. 90% of children age 6 to 18 consume 3.3 milligrams of sodium daily. I just quoted that number. That's, you know, a third more than is recommended. And those recommended levels are very solidly science-based. Many processed foods are actually deficient in essential nutrients, but which affects the body's mineral balance. For example, lower levels of potassium. That alters calcium levels and oxalate levels in the bloodstream. It's all a cascade effect. These things are designed to be balanced within certain tolerances, and when you mess with those tolerances, you get problems. And we've got problems. We've got climate-related disruptions. We've got food insecurity. We've got people having to move. We've got food deserts, all of which push people to diets that are high in salt, sugar, processed food, and low in the nutrients that might help balance that. And again, water, right? The water supply, the water tastes bad. People drink more juice. They drink more soda, which is, you know, bottled soda is cheaper than bottled water. I want to point out the paradox there, but it is true. Check it out. Ounce per ounce. Another thing that research has turned up that relates to global warming is heat islands, urban heat islands. These are densely populated areas and cities full of buildings, extensively paved, and they experience higher temperatures throughout the year compared with suburban or rural regions. You've got the concrete and the asphalt. They absorb and retain the heat, and then the heat is released slowly at night, keeping also disrupting sleep because it's harder to sleep when you aren't a little bit cold. In an area that has more green spaces and more abundant vegetation, you get more effective heat dissipation and a cooler environment. Planting those plants on the walls of buildings, actually, the plants like the heat. They absorb the heat. They turn it into more plant tissue. This is a win-win. Children are much more susceptible to dehydration, so in those hot environments, they're going to lose more water more quickly through sweating, and this concentrates the minerals in their urine. So there is definitely a social equity piece to this increase in kidney stones in children, but it's a big deal. All right, so we've got time for just a couple more stories. I'm going to talk to you about fartleks. Fartleks just sounds mildly amusing. It's a Swedish word meaning speed play. And no, we're not talking about sexuality here. We're actually talking about workouts, another kind of exercise. So what is a fartlek? Well, they were invented in Sweden by a coach for the Swedish Olympic decathlete and running, Gösta Holmen, who developed it in the 30s after the Swiss cross-country team repeatedly was trounced by the Finns during international competitions. And so what is fartlek? A fartlek is where it's an informal type of interval training. And, you know, as I was reading this, I thought, oh, well, that's, yes, that makes sense. I bet a lot of people invented this in their head on their own. As I did, as a way of just coaching myself to go that extra 10 yards or whatever. You head outside and you warm up for a little bit, whatever activity you're going to be doing, walking, biking, running, snowshoeing. Remember, this was invented in Sweden. Then you pick a landmark a short distance ahead. Could be a tree, a mailbox, an unusual rock formation. There's this one school bus sign halfway up this hill that I'm thinking of in my neighborhood, and you head for that as fast as you can. Short distance. You go as fast as you can. Once you reach it, you drop down to your normal pace. You let your heart rate and breathing slow. When your heart rate's back to baseline, you look for another landmark. You're looking, which is actually quite entertaining, and you should vary the distance between the goals. So maybe you will go, this time you'll say, well, I'm going to pick something a little further away, and I'm not going to go as fast as I can, but I'm going to go fast. And maybe the next time we get there and you're like, oh, I have a little more juice. I think I'll pick that landmark over there and keep rolling at this fast speed. And so you kind of ratchet yourself along. And when you get dyspnea, when you get out breathless, you slow down. And this is really important because if you exercise to the point of being short of breath, that teaches your body that you need to be able to have a higher VO2 max. And unequivocally, your VO2 max is absolutely, positively associated with longevity. Well, that's about all for this week's podcast. Please go to AskDrDawn.com for news about our future plans. For now, this is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.
Ask Dr. Dawn is brought to you by Jiva Media. Production and editing by Charles Mansky. Music by John Scoville.